commentator. Out of Chicago, Eli Joseph James, a radio host and political commentator. And as always, we appreciate you being with us on another debate. I'm Marzia Hashimi. Thank you so much for joining us.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details.
Please listen to verses 9 to 11 of chapter Hud from the Holy Quran, recited by Mr. Sayyid Ahmad Mirzadeh Waqifi.
A'udhu billahi minash shaytanir rajim. Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. وَلَئِنْ أَذَقْنَا الْإِنسَانَ مِنَّا رَحْمَةً ثُمَّ نَزَعْنَاهَا لئن أذقناه نعماء بعد ضراء مسته ليقولن ذهب السيئات عني إنه لفرح فخور إلا الذين صبروا وعملوا الصالحات أولئك لهم مغفرة وأجر كبير إلا الذين صبروا وعملوا الصالحات أولئك لهم مغفرة وأجر كبير صدق الله العلي العظيم.
In the name of God, the most compassionate, the most merciful. And if we make man taste mercy from us, then take it off from him, most surely he is despairing, ungrateful. And if we make him taste a favor after distress has afflicted him, he will certainly say, "The evils are gone away from me." Most surely, he is exulting, boasting. Except those who are patient and do good. They shall have forgiveness and a great reward.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Headlines: the U.S. announces a new arms sales package to Taiwan, the sixth this year, adding to existing tensions with China. Indian farmers protest in New Delhi amid a nationwide strike against new agricultural laws, but they say these could destroy their livelihoods. And the British Prime Minister is set to meet the European Commission President in a bid to save the dying hopes of a post-Brexit trade deal. Thank you for joining us. My name is Gisumi Shahmati, and these are our top stories this hour. The United States has approved the new major arms sales to Taiwan, a deal worth $280 billion, and tensions with China. The package is the sixth this year and includes advanced military communications equipment. The U.S. State Department says the sale is aimed at helping improve the security of Taiwan. The move is expected to spark strong criticism from China that considers Taiwan its own territory. The U.S. under President Donald Trump has finalized 11 weapons deals with the island. Washington has announced $5.1 billion in arms sales this year alone. Taiwanese president says that the island faces daily military threats from what she has described as authoritarian forces. Now, to discuss that further, we're joined by Mr. Andrew K.P. Leung, international and independent Shanghai strategist, joining us live from Hong Kong. Now, Mr. Leung, when the Taiwanese president says that she feels threatened, what exactly does she mean?
Well, of course, Taiwan is a very important issue of China's sovereignty. Taiwan has always been regarded as part of China, And of course, the United States abides by the one China policy. But on the other hand, the United States is increasingly pushing the envelope. There is a bipartisan consensus that China needs to be pushed back on all fronts. And of course, Taiwan is one of the as part of the strategy. And of course, this is supported by the Taiwan Relations Act in the United States, under which the United States government is empowered to strengthen China's Taiwan defenses against perceived kind of threats from the mainland. So I think that, this is the sixth time this year, and then even before this year, there have been numerous times of sales. So I think that this is likely to be a new normal, because Taiwan is regarded by the United States as an unsinkable aircraft carrier to push back against China's perceived acts of coercion, for example, in the Taiwan Strait. So I think that this, we can expect this to continue.
Now, Mr. Liang, is Taiwan threatened by any other countries in the region?
I don't think so. There are some disputes, territorial disputes, some small islets or submerged rocks claimed by both Taiwan and some of the Asian countries. But I think that these territorial claims do not translate into military threats. And of course, that the so-called threat from the mainland is also to prevent Taiwan veering towards kind of semi-independence, because in Beijing, there is already a national law enacted a number of years ago preventing this from happening and backing up against this law against separatism or open declaration of independence as a military deployment of missiles, aircraft carriers, and naval forces. So Taiwan knows it. There is no match in this military strength of Taiwan compared with China. The United States doesn't want to create a war over Taiwan, but it's trying to push the envelope. It's trying to, without breaking the one-China policy, it's selling more and more arms to Taiwan, as I said, as part of the pushback against China.
Thank you very much, Mr. K.P. Liang, international and independent China strategist, joining us live from Hong Kong. Moving on, New Zealand, a New Zealand inquiry into last year's mosque attacks in Christchurch has criticized authorities for ignoring repeated warnings from the Muslim community on rising hate crimes against them. Prime Minister Jacinda Ardern, that is, says the government would act on a proposal for the police to better identify, record, and respond to hate crimes. Ardern admitted that spy agencies failed to focus enough on the threat from far-right terrorists in the run-up to the Christchurch attack. In response to this inquiry, the Muslim Association of Canterbury, where the attack took place, called for an end to state agencies' bias against Muslims.
We've known for a long time that the Muslim community has been unfairly targeted with hate speech and hate crimes. This report shows that we were right. The report shows that institutional prejudice and unconscious bias exists in the government agencies and that needs to change.
The attack saw a gunman open fire at two mosques in Christchurch in mid-March last year. The white supremacist shot at worshippers, including women and children, during Friday prayers. 51 people were killed as a result. Indian farmers have staged a one-day nationwide strike as part of their efforts to make the government repeal its new agriculture laws. The farmers have pledged to block major roads and rail lines across the country for several hours. The government has boosted security across the country. Tens of thousands of farmers have already been camped on the outskirts of the capital since November 27. That is, of course, to protest the law. The legislation opens up trade in agricultural produce. The farmers say it will help major firms take over the agriculture industry and force down prices. The Indian government argues that the changes are needed for the future of the industry. Several rounds of talks have failed to narrow the differences between the two sides. Now, Harish Mander, director of the Center for Equity Studies, is joining us live from New Delhi right now. If you could please explain more on the different aspects of this protest.
In a very brief amount of time, Indian agriculture has been in a very intense crisis for at least 20 years. Now, we have, literally hundreds of thousands of farmers who are committing suicide. There's the whole technological, ecological, marketing, everything is in a crisis. And the large majority of farmers are small and marginal farmers. But there have been a number of commissions which have said that basically farming is no longer an economically viable activity, and it needs significant amounts of support from the state. And that is what they were expecting and hoping, particularly after the lockdown and the level of distress that existed. Instead, what these three laws have done, and they passed them firstly as ordinances even without debate, is largely opening up agriculture suddenly. To big multinational corporations who would then control what farmers would produce, what prices they would be paid. Because today there's a monopoly of the state actually purchasing these producers and having a baseline price. So farmers are agitated intensely, and we haven't seen this kind of mobilization for a long time. And please remember that India is passing through a very difficult period in its democracy, where dissenters are being treated. There are a huge number of criminal cases against me because of the protests that we did against the citizenship law, etc. So in a climate where there is intense fear of dissent, this kind of mobilization and farmers coming together. And one very beautiful aspect of it is that they've also used this as an opportunity for demonstrating unity between people of different faiths. So the farmers are significant number six, but they're being invited to live in mosques, and Muslim people are feeding them and taking care and joining the protests. So it's a very significant moment in the journey of our republic.
Thank you very much, Mr. Harish Mander, Director of the Center for Equity Studies, live from New Delhi. Moving on, the European Union and the UK remain divided on key issues as time is running out for the two sides to clinch a post-Brexit trade deal. Diplomatic sources from both sides said that there has been no progress in talks on Monday, with some noting that the prospect for an agreement has become even narrower than before. In a joint statement, EU Chief Ursula von der Leyen and British Prime Minister Boris Johnson said a deal is impossible due to disagreements on critical issues. The two leaders added that they will have an in-person discussion in Brussels ahead of the Wednesday deadline for the talks. Differences remain over fisheries, business rules, and trade in Northern Ireland after the Brexit transition period expires at the end of this month.
For Brexit supporters and many coastal communities, this deal symbolises regaining sovereignty in an age-old dispute over fishing rights. The UK says British fishing grounds are first and foremost for British boats, but the EU wants things to stay relatively the same, with access for its boats and no tariffs or taxes on goods crossing borders. The EU's bargaining chip is special access to the EU single market, which the UK wants to hold on to, as 60% of the fish its boats catch is sold to the bloc. The EU says something's got to give, though, insisting Britain cannot have priority access to its own fisheries and the EU market.
Mais comment expliquer aux pêcheurs?
How do we explain to fishermen that they can't go into British waters, but then they import fish to Bologna? That's very complicated, believe me.
Wars have almost been waged over these fishing waters. Britain and Iceland clashed over cod between the 1950s and 1970s, with the Royal Navy deploying 37 warships to protect British interests. The Scallop Wars in 2018, that saw French and British trawlmen come to blows in the English Channel, threatened an uneasy truce reached in 2012, when the UK agreed to keep larger boats away from French waters in exchange for additional access rights. Since Britain formally left the EU on January 31st, negotiators have missed a series of deadlines to reach a deal with the world's largest trading bloc before the transition period ends on December 31st. And although the UK hopes these really are the last few days before a deal, it is not ruling out an extension.
I think we probably are now in the final few days in terms of being able to decide whether there can be an agreement. Of course, look, if the ambience warms up again and actually great progress is made and it's just about sorting out the detail, well, then you can always find more time, you can always extend. But I think unless we can resolve these quite fundamental divergences at the moment, then we are going to have to take a position in the next few days.
If a satisfactory deal is not reached, the British economy, which has already been battered by the COVID-19 pandemic, will suffer even more. And it will also mean bilateral trade falling back on World Trade Organization rules for 2021, which is far from Brexit's purported goal of taking back control. Bianca Rahimi, London.
Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan says he believes a win-win formula can be found in the row with Greece over the Eastern Mediterranean tensions. His remarks come as the European Union is mulling sanctions on Turkey ahead of an upcoming key summit. Rashan Sagla reports.
The EU is set to decide on sanctions against Turkey over Eastern Mediterranean tensions this week. European Union final decision will take place on Thursday on the grounds of recommendations from the EU foreign ministers meeting. The EU has been involved in Ankara-Athens tensions for a while now, since Turkey sent a search vessel to a disputed area. This comes as Turkish president is seeking to push for dialogue between conflicting parties and countries of the Mediterranean, including North and South Cyprus, assuring that Turkey is only after what belongs to it.
We are not after exploiting anyone's rights, but are only taking a firmer stance against pirates that try to take our rights away. All actors will be able to find a win-win solution when everyone acts consciously with common sense and sincerity.
Turkey and Greece have been at loggerheads over the Eastern Mediterranean underwater energy resources dispute. Ankara enraged Athens by sending a research vessel to a disputed area in August, and since then, Greece has been calling EU to take actions against Turkey. However, many say it is not easy for the EU to take actions against Turkey for several reasons, including refugee deal and economic relations between Ankara and the bloc.
There is a division inside the EU when it comes to Turkey. There is an alliance led by France that is pushing for sanctions against Turkey due to latest tensions with Greece. There is another alliance on the other side led by Germany that is trying to reach consensus on a solution for the conflict. So the EU remains divided and imposing sanctions on Turkey.
Turkey says it had already shown goodwill when retrieving a Ruch Reis vessel and agreeing on dialogue without preconditions. Many here believe the EU will not take serious actions against Turkey and is only after pushing Turkey to stop its activities in the region until a solution is found. Rashan Saglam, Istanbul.
The European Union foreign ministers have adapted a plan aimed at making the 27-nation bloc less dependent on the United States, the United Kingdom, and China. The ministers argue that the chaotic presidency of Donald Trump has highlighted the necessity for such a move. Jerome Hughes reports.
During Donald Trump's 4 years in office, relations between the European Union and the United States deteriorated so badly that the sides almost became bitter adversaries. Washington's illegal economic sanctions against Iran have prevented EU firms from doing business with the Islamic Republic. Apparently, it is an example of why the bloc needs to become more autonomous.
We don't accept this kind of extraterritoriality, but in practical terms, it has effects. Well, if we don't accept, we should be able to resist it.
Aside from the Iran nuclear deal, officially called the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, Trump has pushed back against the EU on trade, climate change, and how to handle COVID-19. Those are only a few examples. EU foreign affairs ministers have just adopted a policy document designed to repair the damage when Joe Biden enters the White House next month. The document states we need to work together to preserve the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action as endorsed by United Nations Security Council Resolution 2231, 2015. But despite the EU's seemingly positive ambitions, there are many analysts who agree the nuclear deal will not be saved because ultimately the Biden administration will bow to Israeli regime pressure. Trump's hate speech towards Iran, fueled by the powerful Israel lobby, has been relentless during the past 4 years.
We're going to be hit you with a force 1,000 times bigger than you've ever been hit before.
Despite Trump and Israel's best efforts, some expert analysts believe Iran's political leaders can still save the nuclear deal.
It is a sensitive issue. And like in the U.S. Congress, also in the Iranian parliament, there are people who are, if not opposed, at least critical. But the foreign ministry and the government, I think, are very, very determined to carry out this deal.
Biden has said he wants to re-engage with Iran. Tehran has made it clear matters will not be progressed at any price. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
That brings us to the end of this edition of World News.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
The Supplication on Tuesdays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, and praise is His right, since Him deserves it, abundant praise. I seek refuge in Him from the evil of my soul, for surely the soul commands to evil, except as my Lord has mercy. I seek refuge in Him from the evil of Satan, who adds sins to my sin. I seek protection with Him from every wicked tyrant and unjust sovereign and conquering enemy. O Allah, place me among Thy troops are the victors, and place me in Thy party, for Thy party are the ones who prosper. and place me among thy friends, for thy friends no fear shall be upon them, nor shall they sorrow. O Allah, set right for me my religion, for it is the preserving tie of my affair. Set right for me my hereafter, for it is the abode of my permanent lodging, and to it I flee from the neighborhood of the vile. Make life an increase for me in every good, and death an ease for me from every evil. O Allah, bless Muhammad, the seal of the prophets, and the completion of the number of the envoys, and his household, the good, the pure, and his household, the good, the pure, and his companions, the distinguished. And give me on the Tuesday three things. Leave no sin for me unless thou forgives it, and leave no grief unless thou takes it away, and leave no enemy, and leave no enemy unless thou repelst him. By means of in the name of Allah, the best of the names, in the name of Allah, Lord of earth and heaven, I seek to repulse every hateful thing, the first of which is his anger, and I seek to attract every lovable thing, the first of which is his good pleasure. So seal me with forgiveness from thee, O patron of beneficence.
When detainees at an Alabama jail got sick or simply asked to be tested, they were put in solitary confinement, says Clarissa Donnelly D. Roven, writer, in an article published under the heading, Immigrants Detained by ICE Say They Were Punished for Requesting COVID-19 Tests. Here's the details of this article. ETOA, which contracts with the federal government to hold people detained by U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement, stated in court documents that it was taking precautions recommended by the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, including quarantining new arrivals, implementing social distancing measures, and providing cleaning supplies. But Golding and more than a dozen other ICE detainees say the measures taken were inadequate and led to a massive COVID-19 outbreak. Seven of the men say they were given only one disposable mask every 3 weeks. One shared a photo of what he said were the only cleaning supplies he'd received: a toothbrush, toothpaste, comb, and combination shampoo body wash, which came inside a gift bag from the Salvation Army emblazoned with the words Merry Christmas. Immigrants inside ETOA also said that many new arrivals were quarantined for 5 or 8 days rather than the recommended 2-week period, potentially allowing the virus to spread. According to a partial ETOA roster obtained by The Intercept, and in these times, ICE transferred at least 24 people into the facility in June. By the second half of July, the agency reported that 21 detainees, nearly a quarter of those housed in ETOWA's ICE unit, were sick. When Golding came out of his cell and saw the condition of those around him, the organizer part of his brain clicked back. I'm looking at people that's literally looking play in the face, he said. And medical is doing nothing for them. Golding decided to tell everyone in the unit to request a test for COVID-19. So you have Africans, you have Jamaicans, you have El Salvadorans, you have different groups, Golding explained. What I did was say, hey, listen, you talk to your people, you tell them this. Many people were apprehensive about asking for a test, as guards had already put the few who were presumed positive into solitary confinement, a fate the United Nations says amounts to torture. In solitary, detainees said they were locked in cells without air conditioning for around 23 hours a day. The average high temperature in July in Gadsden is 91 degrees. Nevertheless, by July 4th, everyone in the unit, more than 80 people, had put in requests to be tested, according to interviews with Golding and another detainee, as well as the affidavits of 9 detainees included in a petition for a writ of habeas. Golding filed on his own behalf in the Northern District of Alabama in September. 2 days later, according to the 11 detainees, Etowah County Sheriff's Officer Captain Mike O'Brien called the lockdown of the unit and read out the names of 10 detainees who'd been especially vocal in calling for mass testing, including Golding. O'Brien told them to pack their bags because they were being sent to solitary confinement. At the time of their transfer, none had tested positive for COVID-19. All 11 sources said they felt this was punishment and retaliation for requesting the coronavirus test. I noticed that all of us who were randomly picked were the ones who were vocal, outspoken, and shown desire to be tested, Stanley Walden wrote in a complaint dated on August 7th. He handpicked cells and made an example in front of everyone that he really meant to throw anyone who get tested into a dungeon, Sebastian Abalo-Kana wrote in a complaint dated on July 28. It feels like punishment for standing up for our right to health and safety, he said. After locking down the unit, the captain and other staff members went cell to cell asking the remaining detainees if they still wanted to be tested for COVID-19, according to Golding and the affidavits of 9 others. Most detainees revoked their request and agreed to sign waivers saying they no longer wanted to be tested. In a recorded conversation involving 2 Etowah employees obtained by The Intercept and in These Times, one employee described the events of the July 6th as an attempt to bully people into not getting tested. Afterwards, both employees said in the recording, immigrants inside Etowah appear too scared to seek even basic medical care. 4 of those who were sent to solitary confinement said they were unable to communicate with their families for days, leading some concerned family members to call the facility. The relatives of one detainee said jail staff assured them that their family member was fine at the time he was in solitary confinement, having developed symptoms of COVID-19. Golding's mother said she was told there was no evidence of the virus at the facility, even as ICE listed at least 1 coronavirus case at Etowah on its website. According to the family members interviewed for this story, neither ICE nor Etowah ever reached out to tell them their loved ones were sick. The Etowah County Sheriff's Office did not respond to detailed questions from The Intercept and in These Times about the jail's COVID-19 precautions, the detainees' allegations of retaliation, and whether detainees had authorized the release of their medical information to family members. The health, safety, and welfare of those in our care remain a top priority and concern for the agency, a spokesperson for ICE wrote in an emailed statement. Since the outbreak of COVID-19, ICE has taken extensive
steps to safeguard all detainees, staff, and contractors, including reducing the number of detainees in custody by placing individuals on alternatives to detention programs, suspending social visitation, incorporating social distancing practices with staggered meals and recreation times, and through the use of cohorting and medical isolation. IC's public guidance on how detention centers should respond to the pandemic says facilities must ensure that medical isolation is operationally distinct from administrative or disciplinary segregation or any punitive form of housing. Yet, as a previous investigation by The Intercept found, a number of IC facilities have failed to adhere to this requirement. According to detainees at Etowah, solitary confinement was used not only as leverage to discourage requests for testing, but also to isolate people with COVID-19. The Intercept and In These Times spoke with five men who tested positive for COVID-19 while detained at Etowah. Each said he spent weeks in solitary confinement. Chamoe Edwards developed COVID-19 symptoms just days before going. At first, he planned to quietly sweat out the illness, but with a history of bronchitis and a recent diagnosis of sickle cell trait, he got too scared to ride it out on his own. He hobbled over to an officer and told him he felt like he'd been hit by a truck. Not long afterwards, Edwards said he was transferred to solitary confinement. The men universally described the conditions in solitary confinement as squalid. In their affidavits, many expressed distress that they no longer had access to mental health professionals, the law library, sunlight, or fresh air. Civil detention have turned into torture, Fele Koroma said. Bakarir Majidov, who was deported in September, wrote that there were cockroaches and flies in the unit. Golding wrote that he was fed uncooked frozen food and didn't have access to drinking water because the sink in his cell didn't flow properly. One detainee said he spent 21 days in isolation. Another counted 35 days and a third counted 54. Golding said he was in solitary confinement from July 6 until August 28. Edwards said he was put in isolation on June 29th and wasn't released until July 28. "We were getting the same treatments as when you get in trouble," Edwards said in an interview. "Even though it's properly a different word, it's isolation. It's still a form of punishment, a form of torture that they are putting us in." Edwards received the results from his coronavirus test on July 8. He was positive. One day later, Golding received the same bad news. In isolation, the men say their phone access was limited. They could only make calls during a brief daily free period, no more than 75 minutes, which occurred on an irregular schedule. Sometimes they said it might be in the middle of the night. Before he got sick, Edwards would speak with his mother and brother a few times each week. After not hearing from him during the 5 weeks of July, his brother, Nico Edwards, who is a police officer in Flint, Michigan, called Etowah. The first person he spoke to transferred him to someone else. "That person answered and told me that they looked in the computer and they told me Shamoy is okay. He's on the floor and nothing is wrong with him." Nikoi believed the facility at first. Then a few weeks later, his brother finally called, telling Nikoi he was in solitary confinement and had the coronavirus. The U.S. criminal justice system and the immigration system are deeply entangled, with harsh consequences for black immigrants in particular. One out of every five people facing deportation because of a criminal conviction is black. As of July, about half of the people detained by ICE at Etowah were black, including Golding, Edwards, and many of the other men interviewed for this story. Several are lawful permanent residents who lost their green cards and became deportable after criminal convictions. Rather than accept deportation, many immigrants remain at Etowah for years as they fight their cases, often because they have nothing to go back to. Golding and Edwards were both born in Jamaica and came to the United States of America as children. Edwards, now 30, arrived at 15 on a green card. Most of his family now lives in the United States. Golding, now 36, arrived at age 9 to reunite with his mother, who had fled an abusive relationship. He has never been back to Jamaica. Before being incarcerated by ICE, Golding served a 10-year sentence in federal prison. He and his family say they didn't know there would be immigration consequences for his criminal conviction and that he was served his time.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
European News Bulletin.
Welcome, my name is Amina Taylor, and we're coming to you from London. Now, tense news as a senior EU diplomat says the European Union's chief Brexit negotiator, Michel Barnier, is rather downbeat about the prospects of sealing a new trade deal with Britain. This after a weekend of tense negotiations. Barnier briefed the bloc's national ambassadors in Brussels on Monday. He told envoys the EU and London were still not on the same page and that the ball is now firmly in the court of British Prime Minister Boris Johnson. Brexit sticking points have been whittled down to access to UK fishing waters, and the so-called level playing field, as Bianca Rahimi reports.
For Brexit supporters and many coastal communities, this deal symbolises regaining sovereignty in an age-old dispute over fishing rights. The UK says British fishing grounds are first and foremost for British boats, but the EU wants things to stay relatively the same, with access for its boats and no tariffs or taxes on goods crossing borders. The EU's bargaining chip is special access to the EU single market, which the UK wants to hold on to, as 60% of the fish its boats catch is sold to the bloc. The EU says something's got to give, though, insisting Britain cannot have priority access to its own fisheries and the EU market.
Mais comment expliquer aux pêcheurs?
How do we explain to fishermen that they can't go into British waters, but then they import fish to Bologna? That's very complicated, believe me.
Wars have almost been waged over these fishing waters. Britain and Iceland clashed over cod between the 1950s and 1970s, with the Royal Navy deploying 37 warships to protect British interests. The Scallop Wars in 2018 that saw French and British trawlmen come to blows in the English Channel threatened an uneasy truce reached in 2012, when the UK agreed to keep larger boats away from French waters in exchange for additional access rights. Since Britain formally left the EU on January 31st, negotiators have missed a series of deadlines to reach a deal with the world's largest trading bloc before the transition period ends on December 31st. And although the UK hopes these really are the last few days before a deal, it is not ruling out an extension.
I think we probably are now in the final few days in terms of being able to decide whether there can be an agreement. Of course, look, if the ambience warms up again and actually great progress is made and it's just about sorting out the detail, well, then you can always find more time, you can always extend. But I think unless we can resolve these quite fundamental divergences at the moment, then, we are going to have to take a position in the next few days.
If a satisfactory deal is not reached, the British economy, which has already been battered by the COVID-19 pandemic, will suffer even more. And it will also mean bilateral trade falling back on World Trade Organization rules for 2021, which is far from Brexit's purported goal of taking back control. Bianca Rahimi, London.
And as these negotiations go down to the wire behind closed doors, both Brussels and London must be mindful of public opinion on this ultimate game of brinkmanship. Well, as are we. So we took to the streets of the capital and got some reactions.
It's a pretty difficult position, to be honest. The negotiations have been going on for 4 and a bit years, so you'd hope that they got to a resolution. But at the end of the day, you want a good deal rather than a deal that would compromise our rights. And personally, I think the main area is services. We haven't done a good job enough for the city. We're focusing on fishing, which is a massive part of our GDP. We should be looking at other priorities. So not too happy that that's turned into a political statement rather than an actual business one.
Economically, for sure, it would be worse off to leave the EU in the short term, but it might be better in like the medium to long term. But that depends on what kind of deal they struck, or if there is no deal, then I think nobody knows what will happen.
Well, I think there's a lot of brinkmanship going on, and I guess something will magically resolve itself before the end of the year. What kind of deal that is, I don't know, but I think the French are being over demanding on the fish, so they might have to give way on that. The Germans want to sell us cars and wouldn't want tariffs, and yeah, we want to sell and trade in Europe, so there's probably a bit of give and take on both sides, I guess.
But I believe in God, and that whatever will be, it will work out okay, and we'll all be all right in the long run. So I'm relaxed about it, basically.
I think that there kind of needs to be extension, but every time they always leave until the last minute to rush these deals, and then they say they haven't got enough time. So I'd say they have an extension, but then are they just going to repeat the same thing again? Are we just going to have another few days left and then have to have another extension as well? So
I mean, it can't go on for much longer, because the European people, they're just getting more irritated and more irritated. I mean, now Macron is getting very vicious altogether, and I'm not English, but you know, when you look back on what the English did for the French during two world wars, They saved them from annihilation, and yet the French can turn around and be very vicious when they feel like it. So get out now, is my advice.
Yes, it sounds to me as though there's a certain amount of lack of goodwill on both sides, I suspect. I don't feel that everybody's making a huge effort necessarily, at least not from what's reported. I'd be slightly surprised if there were an extension. It feels like the British government would quite like to get out of there with no solution. That's what it feels like to me, anyway.
Some other news now, as more unrest in France, as protest against police violence and a new draft security bill quickly disintegrated into clashes as police used tear gas and trenches in an attempt to disperse the crowds. The march began peacefully enough, with thousands of people waving banners and chanting slogans against the government and the police. However, violence soon erupted.
To see all the police present surrounding us is crazy. It's as if we're criminals. The government treats the protesters as criminals.
This means a lot to me. I was a victim of police violence in April last year. I took a hit from a truncheon by a riot policeman, which broke my neck. Since then, I've been scared of the police. I no longer trust them, and I will never trust them.
Weeks of protests have forced President Emmanuel Macron to take another look at his draft security law, which criminalizes the video recording of police. Macron also acknowledged that ethnic minorities were more likely to be stopped by police after footage emerged of officers assaulting a black music producer. Police unions have responded angrily to the president's comments. While Chris Denhond is in program, Macron has said he will take another look at this controversial security bill. But will this be enough?
Protesters, they demand, and because the actual, the current existing laws are more than sufficient to punish criminal behavior. So there is also a second problem for Macron. People inside his government, the high government circles, they want to rewrite the law because they are not happy with the way that the French government is dealing with the security issue. And then there is a third element, inside the Senate, with a right-wing majority, they also want to rewrite this law. So it will take a while before this law will be applied, it will be put into practice. And in the meantime, it's very probable that the protests will go on.
Now, Macron is dealing with not just this situation, but accusations of Islamophobia. Tough times for the French president here, Chris.
Yes, well, he positioned himself, since he is president, in the center of the political spectrum. But in fact, his political practice, he is looking to his right and even to his far right. So he is copying parts of the far right party of Marine Le Pen concerning Muslims, concerning migrants, and concerning the way the security issue is dealt with. His problem is the more he looks to his right, the more there is discontent on his left. So it's a dangerous situation for him because when there were when there were terrorist attacks, the public opinion, also under influence of the mass media, is going to the right and to the far right. But if he goes too much to the right, there is a real discount on the left, and people go, they take the streets, and when the lockdown is less severe and when demonstrations are authorized, which happens last weeks, people are on a massive way participating in demonstrations.
Now on a final note, and very quickly for me here, Chris, he's got elections in April of 2022. This must worry him right now, the fact that he doesn't quite seem to be getting the balance right.
Well, he is really preparing his these elections. It's in less than a year. And the same thing. He is looking, the main danger for him is coming from the far right, Marine Le Pen, National Front Party. And on the left side, the progressive side, there are different candidates, like Mélenchon, the Communist Party has a candidate. There will be other candidates. It's more divided. His main danger to be re-elected comes from the far right. That's why he's looking to the right at the moment.
All right, problems ahead there for the French president. Chris Denholm, thank you.
This is European News Bulletin broadcast by IRIB English Radio. In this program, we covered the most recent developments all over Europe. You can listen to this program on Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, and Saturday.
Robert, in Lakesh, 9,000 new Jewish homes in a Jerusalem area here in Al-Quds. I mean, this pays total lie and a sham to any ideas of peace, surely.
Absolutely. The Zionist entity has just approved 9,000 settler units, and specifically a settlement which is located in East Jerusalem, Al-Quds. It's called Atarot. Now, Atarot settlement will essentially isolate once it's expanded with these 9,000 settler units. Isolate Ramallah to the north of East Jerusalem from East Jerusalem itself. And it's part of this larger effort by the Zionist entity to attempt to cut off Jerusalem al-Quds from the Palestinian people and prevent it from being a Palestinian capital in the future. We know that under a two-state solution, the Palestinian capital is supposed to be based in Jerusalem al-Quds and East Jerusalem al-Quds. And the other settlements, of course, in that area, like Givat HaMatos and also Ramat Shlomo, are also being expanded. So it's part of an effort by Israel to specifically attempt to isolate Palestinians from East Jerusalem al-Quds. On top of that, right now, they're undergoing a large-scale ethnic cleansing program inside of East Jerusalem al-Quds, with a massive expulsion campaign going on, and whilst they're demolishing Palestinian homes, around 400 Palestinians have been made homeless just in East Jerusalem al-Quds this year alone, which is a phenomenal figure. This is really should be alarming. However, the international community is, it has failed time and time again to act. In fact, the statements coming out from them aren't even strong enough on these sort of things, let alone any sort of action coming about. So it just shows the international community is not in favor of actually delivering peace.
Indeed, and we have to remember, of course, that Netanyahu has elections, so this might be another pivot towards that.
Absolutely. This is something that Netanyahu, he will use to pander to his far-right base, and it's sort of projected that Netanyahu will go after trying to install a far-right religious government along with Naftali Bennett and his party, which, of course, if he's going to do that, he has to bring on the settler bloc. And this is, of course, 800,000 people, so there's a lot of people he's pandering to there.
Well, you know, it doesn't matter if Palestinian lives are at stake, if you can get your grubby hands on a few more votes. On to the social media reaction here.
The first one we've got here says, a two-state solution has been impossible for some time. Palestinians now need simple rule over their state. We have another one here as well commenting on this who says, we can all thank the UAE for recognizing the fascist apartheid occupation to stop this happening. Oh, wait, never mind.
And we move from an occupation entity to, well, what's going on in Michigan there?
Well, another settler colonial project, of course, is having its far-right moments. Donald Trump's crowd seem to be riding on the wave that has been created of this culture war, and actually threatening the Secretary of State over, of course, what's going on to do with the voting system in Michigan. And we've seen that this is not just in one state. We've seen that armed Trump supporters around the country belonging to a lot of white supremacist groups as well have been threatening a lot of state officials and have even attempted to kidnap state officials for what they see as a threat on their rights and liberties. And of course, Trump is fueling this all the way. He's still not accepting his defeat to Joe Biden. His supporters absolutely do not accept his defeat. Even though he hasn't accepted the defeat, he is accepting that he's not going to be inaugurated again in January, as he is running a rally on that day, a pro-Trump rally he's going to be running on Inauguration Day. So it doesn't seem that he'll actually turn up there, as traditionally has been followed by presidents who lose their position or have completed their time in office. And Trump looks to be running, wanting to run in 2024. So it seems like this will go on for some time now.
Nothing's been traditional about this system, and perhaps just really shaken America's facade of democracy there, but your online reactions, the ones that you've scoped out, would be of interest to me.
The first we have here says, is this the well-regulated militia described in the 2A? Question mark. I think not. More like a dangerous group of right-wing nuts emboldened with deadly weapons. We have another one here as well who says, Trump's behavior and rhetoric has emboldened his swamp to be criminally aggressive. This is not news, but things have heated up in Michigan. Trump needs to be held accountable for the actions that he encourages.
All right, Robert and Lakesh, obviously we'll continue to monitor the two stories you brought to our attention. Thank you. In some other news now, into Spain we go, because hundreds of far-right Vox supporters gathered in several major cities over the weekend to voice their contempt for the COVID-19 restrictions being imposed by the government. Speaking to local news outlets, protesters stated that, quote, Prime Minister Pedro Sanchez had taken away their freedoms and destroyed the economy. Also attending the protest, Vox party leader Santiago Abascal said that the constitution was at risk as the COVID-19 restrictions were eroding the rights of citizens. Counter-protests were blocked by police from congregating in the same area as Vox demonstrators to prevent clashes. 70 COVID-19 clinics have opened in the Russian capital just days after President Vladimir Putin ordered a large-scale immunization program. During a news conference, President Putin declared that the Russian-made Sputnik V vaccine will be made available to groups most at risk to the disaster, with the list including doctors, nurses, teachers, and social workers. Earlier last week, Russia's health minister, Mikhail Murashko, also announced that the country had already tested the vaccine on more than 100,000 of its citizens. So far,